From WIPR, I'm Sheila Cast. We're on the record. 50 years ago, a team headed by Johns Hopkins sociologist James Coleman got a congressional mandate to figure out how to make educational opportunity more equal. They surveyed hundreds of thousands of students. One conclusion, that a child's family has more bearing on academic success than school. We'll talk to three experts, including one who helped write the Coleman Report.
And really, the questions asked is why this report is remembered to this day. It was really about what matters to make a good school. No one had any idea about what affected student learning.
It's on the record after the news.
You're listening to On the Record, the podcast, a service of your public radio, 88.1 WYPR. Find more podcasts online at wypr.org. And tell us what you think. Send an email to ontherecord@wypr.org.
Good morning, I'm Sheila Cast. We're on the record. 50 years ago, a research team headed by sociologist James Coleman of Johns Hopkins surprised a lot of people with a report that included more than 600,000 interviews at 4,000 schools across the country. The fact of the report wasn't the surprise. 2 years earlier, in the Civil Rights Act of 1964, Congress had mandated a study of equality of educational opportunity. Coleman and his team took that mandate and ran with it. Some of the findings they published in 1966 were revolutionary. The Lyndon Johnson administration, for example, didn't expect a finding that investments in school facilities and other so-called inputs were less important to student achievement than family background. And many Americans were not ready for the conclusion that poor black children learn better in well-integrated classrooms. The Coleman Report probably had more impact than any other research project in the 20th century on how America educates its kids. It's still having impact. And tomorrow, Johns Hopkins School of Education opens a two-day conference on the report's impact and educational inequality. One of the co-chairs of that conference, Carl Alexander, joins me. Carl Alexander is the John Dewey Professor Emeritus of Sociology at Johns Hopkins. One of his own best-known contributions to understanding inequality was his report in 2014, The Long Shadow. Welcome to On the Record.
Well, thank you for having me here today, Sheila.
It's a 700-page report. Thousands of pages have been written interpreting it, but I'm still going to ask you, 50 years on, what's the most important thing we should know about the Coleman Report?
The differences in the conditions of schooling, the schools attended by minority children and whites, were not large enough to explain for us the differences in school performance that are characteristic across social lines, comparing the test scores of African-American children and white children. So if the schools weren't the driving force, or conditions of schooling weren't the driving force, what then was the explanation? And the report directed our attention to the importance of family conditions for children's school performance and educational development. And so over time, I think that emerged as one of the main takeaway points from the report, that family is the primary driver of children's unequal school performance and schools play a secondary role. And that was shocking. People were not expecting that as the conclusion, as one of the more fundamental conclusions from the report.
The idea that poor kids do better in integrated classrooms, I mean, did the report study this as a matter of class or a matter of race?
Well, in fact, it looked at both characteristics. It looked at the makeup of the school the children attended, including the socioeconomic makeup or the characteristics of family in terms of parents' educational level. And it also looked at the racial and ethnic composition of the school as considerations that might help us understand unequal school performance. And while both race and family background emerged as predictive of children's school performance, far and away, the socioeconomic makeup of the school was the overriding factor as far as the report was concerned. Now, for balance, we're talking about the socioeconomic makeup of the school the children attend as against the socioeconomic characteristics of the families the children grow up in. And when you looked at those side by side, family factors trumped school factors by a considerable margin. But when you look just at the conditions of schooling and you compare the racial and ethnic composition of the school against the socioeconomic makeup, the socioeconomic factors really did stand out as powerful drivers of children's uneven school performance. And again, in the context of the time, that proved to be a powerful conclusion for the Johnson administration and other advocates for school desegregation, because what it told us was that if you really want to help poor children and minority children come close to fulfilling their academic potential, the most certain route to doing that would be to get them out of schools that were burdened by high, what we today would call high levels of concentrated poverty, and have them attend schools with a healthy socioeconomic mix, a strong middle-class core.
That's Johns Hopkins sociologist Carl Alexander here on the Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about the seminal study of educational inequality known as the Coleman Report. So the Coleman Report was the argument for busing, which proved to be enormously controversial. I mean, was the Coleman Report misinterpreted in being used in that debate?
The Coleman Report didn't evaluate the consequences of busing. There was no busing at the time as a mechanism for achieving school desegregation. But it informed policies or remedies to try to advance the desegregation cause. And over time, busing to desegregate the schools became one of the means towards that end. But that wasn't really at all addressed in the Coleman Report.
Some people may say public schools are enormously segregated. That's still the case.
Well, that is the case indeed. In fact, levels of segregation today by family economics as well as race and ethnicity rival those from not the 60s, because in the 60s they were virtually completely segregated throughout the country, not just in the South with the dual school system. But by the 70s and into the early 80s, considerable progress had been made in desegregating our public schools. And in fact, the southern region of the country had the most integrated schools in the country at the time. There has been a considerable reversal since those days. So it's more a matter of almost a roller coaster ride, if you will. And starting from the trough where the schools were almost completely desegregated, we made significant advances in integrating our public schools. Over the 10 to 15 year period after the Equality of Educational Opportunity Report. But from that time, over the last 20, 25 years, there's been a very dramatic return to segregated schooling. Not imposed by the force of law, as was the case throughout the South in the Brown era, but through parents making decisions about where they want to live and what kinds of schools they want their children to attend.
I read that you're working on a proposal for mixed-income schools around Baltimore. How would that work?
It's called the Thurgood Marshall Alliance, Thurgood Marshall, in recognition of the of Chief Justice Marshall and his leadership in helping us as a country appreciate the costs that come with segregated schooling. What we're trying to do is mobilize the local expertise here in Baltimore. And the focus of the Thurgood Marshall Alliance will be to identify zoned schools, that is neighborhood schools, not citywide charters, but neighborhood schools in parts of Baltimore City where there are lower income and middle income families living in close proximity. And in point of fact, if you look at the Baltimore map and you know your way around the city, there really are lots of places like that. So these are pockets of opportunity. If these schools could successfully enroll a cross-section of the families that live within their reach, they would be much more racially and socioeconomically integrated than they are at present. So the mission of the Thurgood Marshall Alliance is to partner with a number of these schools and help strengthen their program and practices in ways that will make them more attractive to the families who have options in the parts of the city where these schools are located. And having more options, hopefully, if we do our job well in the Marshall Alliance, many of these families will be encouraged to look at their neighborhood school and say, wow, I've got a really terrific school right around the corner or two or three blocks away. Why do I have to spend $25,000 or $35,000 for independent school tuition? Or why do I have to move out of the city into the county to have a good school experience for my kid? I can do it right down the street. If all goes well in a couple of years, we'll be working with partner schools and helping to strengthen them.
And so that's the timeline, a couple of years?
Yeah, we're working hard on it now. We've had conversations with the leadership at six zone schools throughout the city, and we're about to launch what we're calling a listening tour to engage with parents who live whose children attend those schools, but also parents who live in the neighborhood around those schools, to try to gain a deeper understanding of what their interests are and what they think about the prospects available to them for their children's schooling locally.
Thank you for talking to us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you for having me in.
Sociology Professor Emeritus Carl Alexander is co-chair, along with Steve Morgan, Bloomberg Distinguished Professor of Sociology and Education, of a conference that starts tomorrow on the Coleman Report at 50. We have more information at the On the Record page at WYPR.org, including a link to where you can listen to the live-streamed conference. I'm Sheila Cass. Quick break, and then another perspective on the Coleman Report. Stick with us.
This is the On the Record podcast, a service of Your Public Radio, member-supported 88.1 WYPR. You can support this podcast and everything you hear from WYPR. Become a member. Come to WYPR.org and click the donate link.
Welcome back. It's On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about the groundbreaking Coleman Report 5 decades after it shook attitudes about multiracial education. In the Civil Rights Act of 1964, Congress mandated a study of equality of educational opportunity. Barbara Desmond has been thinking about the implications of the Coleman Report for decades. She is education chair for the Maryland State Conference of the NAACP, as well as head of Desmond Educational Strategies, a consulting firm. Dr. Desmond worked with the Maryland State Department of Education on several important studies, including its initial report on minority achievement. And Barbara Desmond joins us by phone. Welcome to On the Record.
Thank you so much, Ms. Cass.
This massive research project that the sociologist James Coleman put together, questionnaires to 4,000 schools across the country about more than 600,000 pupils, one of the areas it probed was students' attitudes, how they looked at school, what they felt about their own prospects. Tell us about those findings.
When students enter schools, we've known as educators for years that they bring certain attitudes associated with their backgrounds to the school and to the learning process. What has happened in education over the years, it's a case of looking at something right in front of us, yet we don't seem to address it appropriately. Students come to school, particularly students from diverse backgrounds and those from lower socioeconomic backgrounds, not with deficits. They bring resilience with them. However, they do come without the necessary knowledge of the culture of the school. Thus, we find over time that we have students that are not failing subjects academically, but we have students who are failing school and adjusting to the generic type of education we offer. And I think that's what Dr. Coleman had pointed to quite succinctly in his study.
Coleman put a great emphasis on the skills and attitudes that all pupils bring from home, whether they're useful attitudes or not. And that seemed to put less emphasis on the school and on the skills of teaching. Unpack that for us. What do you see as the message of the Coleman Report there?
Really, Coleman in his report and his assertions, he is not taking away from the importance of the teacher. Rather, he is prioritizing the importance of other factors that influence the education of children. We, for instance, have known for years as an educational fact that the quality of the teacher really correlates with the quality of instruction, and then there's a correlation with the quality of academic achievement. Coleman, in focusing on the results, goes back to the classroom and looks on it as, well, we are having a teacher here who is highly qualified, and yet some students may be achieving while other students aren't. So he starts looking at it in the social context of the classroom as to a reason for why this achievement isn't occurring equitably across student populations. He finds that when you're looking at instruction, that the student's background, the student's sense of self-esteem, those influence in turn the student's readiness to learn, the student's appreciation of the instruction that he's receiving. Thus, that will influence the student's attitude toward the learning experience and the results that you can expect. One factor does not necessarily negate the other. I think quite often when people look at Coleman, they tend to take some of the more controversial stances, and they forget all about the nuance and the intricacies of the children and the learning experience.
Well, of course, one of the controversial findings, or something that is sometimes shorthanded in a controversial way, was the finding in the Coleman report that poor black kids learn best when they are in majority middle class schools, which sounded to some people as if the report was saying there's something sort of magical about black kids sitting next to white kids in class. What do you tell people about that?
I think that that is just as wrong as this other, that you have an opposing premise that students learn best in schools where they're surrounded with peers of their own race, etc. I think one premise is just as false as the other. We do know, and there is research that supports the theory that students learn better in diverse settings. But that's rather complicated. It's just not about race. It's students learning better with students, let's say, with whom they're grouped, who come with different ability levels, different skill levels, that students quite often play off of their peers, that they can help each other, that they are more stimulated to learn. It's not as simple as equating it just with a racial situation.
You have led several important assessments of education in this state, including the 2000 study, Minority Achievement in Maryland at the Millennium. Putting all that together, how would you describe the impact of the Coleman report here in this state?
One of the most important aspects of the Coleman report when looking at how Maryland began to address academic achievement is that prior to Coleman, we were so busy in education, we're sort of narcissistic. We were so busy looking at the inputs, what we had, what we were offering to students. And quite often, that led us to give a more positive portrayal of what was occurring in the educational situation. However, along comes Coleman, and he starts talking about outcomes. And he starts measuring those outcomes. Let's look at the test scores. Let's look at what these children are actually achieving, and which would be reflected in their tests. That, to me, was one of the most significant aspects of the Coleman report, and that played a crucial role in Maryland's minority report, which was landmark for its time, and for other states' minority reports, and the way we handle data. So we are very grateful to Dr. Coleman for that contribution to education.
I'm very grateful to you for this conversation. Thank you.
Thank you.
Barbara Desmond, who heads Desmond Educational Strategies, a consulting firm, is education chair of the Maryland State Conference of the NAACP. This is On the Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking today about the influential and controversial study written 50 years ago by a team led by the late Johns Hopkins University sociologist James Coleman. Jim McPartland was one of Coleman's graduate students and went on to become executive director of the Center for Social Organization of Schools. Jim McPartland, welcome to On the Record.
Thank you. Nice to be with you.
How did you get involved in the Equality of Educational Opportunity study?
Well, I was a second-year graduate student at Hopkins in Baltimore, and Congress asked Coleman to take on this task. So the agency called him up, and I was one of his students, and he said, why don't you move to Washington tomorrow to be part of a very nice national project? And that's exactly what I did. I packed my bags, relocated, and was part of the team and that worked for the next year and a half to produce this report.
So you were part of deciding what the questions would be, what the
would be. Coleman really deserves all the credit for the design, the analysis, and so on. And really, the questions asked is why this report is remembered to this day. It was really about what matters to make a good school. What are the things you'd change if you wanted to make a poor school into a good school? No one had any idea about what affected student learning. There were all kinds of rumors, like the money you spent. The South was being castigated for not putting money into the segregated schools.
And what would you say the answer is that the Coleman report found?
Well, the first thing was the family really submerged the school effects and just overtook school effects on being important for student learning. So the schools really were shown to be a weak influence compared to what family advantages or disadvantages you grew up with. The schools actually had a tough time penetrating that. The kids that started out behind from weak backgrounds never really caught up. So that was the first stark thing. Schools are not as powerful as we would hope them to be. And the second one was it wasn't so much how much money is spent on libraries and books and so on. It was who were the fellow students that you went to school with. What was the climate in the school? Was it a school that expected good behavior and high performance, or a school where you could kind of fool around and nobody cared much? And that was determined to a good degree by who were the other kids that you were studying with. Teachers turned out to be somewhat important, but really, again, it was the school climate and the fellow students that turned out to be most important. That, of course, had implications for school desegregation and other controversial policies at the time.
Did the report, which was submitted in 1966, did it have an immediate impact? Were people talking about it immediately?
Well, actually, the government, the higher-ups, I think, were really frightened about the bombshell this might become. So they actually acted to kind of tone it down and submerge it. For example, they hired an outside writer to write the executive summary, which is often what people read, which turned out to be very bland. It was hard to really pick out the big findings. And they published it on the 4th of July, which was the slowest news day, hoping it would kind of be ignored and put on a shelf and forgotten. So it took some folks from Harvard and elsewhere to say, this thing is really earth-shaking. Pay attention.
Did you, when you were working on it, expect it to have that kind of impact?
We really did. From the very beginning, there was almost a tension in the project about, we've kind of got the tiger by the tail here. These questions that we're asking were never asked before, and whatever the result is going to really be worth talking about. So we really thought this has great potential. The other thing, we were under a terrible time urgency. It was really a hectic race to the deadline, because Congress had said this must be published within 2 years, and the government waited 6 months before they invited Coleman to take it on.
So 5 decades later, what should people know about the Coleman Report?
Well, again, how important the families are. The other thing, though, we found that it was the poor kids, the kids from more disadvantaged backgrounds, where schools made the most difference. So even though schools were weak, the poor kids responded most to school improvements. So if you're going to put your money into making schools better, it's these kids that will really benefit. Every extra dollar means more to them than to other children where they have kind of safety nets from the family and so on.
I really appreciate your talking to us about it. Thank you.
One more thing might be of interest to you. We have a reform model we've developed at our Hopkins Center that was inspired by the Coleman study. That is, part of these school improvements we think could make a difference for the poor kids. For example, we use smaller size schools. We break the big school up into smaller parts to try to get this climate of academic excellence part of it. We invest heavily in the kids that come in behind, give them a lot of extra time and a lot of extra help. And we also give them some choice so that they feel that the program is their own. It's for them, not somebody trying to impose something on it. It's something that they want for their own future. It's called the Talent Development High School. And we found that those reforms inspired by the Coleman findings really can make a difference for the kids that come in and really need good schools most.
Some people say they're most struck by the fact that in some ways little has changed.
Well, I think that's mostly true in the school desegregation area. Schools were racially isolated 50 years ago, and we really haven't made much headway on that. We still have segregated districts. The cities are usually mostly minority, the suburbs less so. So that's one big disappointment. And the racial gap in achievement, which was revealed for the first time 50 years ago in the Coleman study. Nobody knew that these gaps in tests were so enormous. That has been gradually closing too. So we're making progress. Still ways to go, but we're moving in the right direction, slowly, however.
Very slowly. But thank you for leaving us on an optimistic note.
Thank you. Nice being with you.
Very nice being with you. Professor Jim McPartland is the former executive director of the Center for the Social Organization of Schools at Johns Hopkins. He was a graduate student 5 decades ago when he worked on the Coleman Report. Professor McPartland will speak tomorrow at a conference the Johns Hopkins School of Education is hosting about the Coleman Report. At the On the Record page at WIPR.org, we have information about the conference and a link to stream it live. I'm Sheila Cast. Glad you've been listening. See you tomorrow.